give everybody a reminder. If you wanted to catch up on any of the studies that you've missed, you can do that via audio at www.beacon-ministries.org or .net. And .net, yep. And if you wanted to see the video, it would be the same thing except .org. And then I do also want to mention, I had a couple of people ask me on some of the some books on the topic. There's two I would really recommend. Actually, three I would really recommend. One is by a guy by the name of Michael S. Heiser. And it's actually called the Unseen Realm. That's probably the most thorough of his writings on the topic. It's a very thought-provoking book. I think you would find that one fascinating if anybody wanted to read through it. The nice thing with it is it's well noted, so he has all kinds of source materials within that book, and there's a website set up where he'll have a footnote, and you go to that website, he'll have an in-depth discussion on that topic, which is really, really an interesting thing. The other one is also a book by him, and it's called Demons by Michael S. Heiser. Also a very fascinating book. And then...
Oh, I just spelled last name, though.
It's H-E-I-S-E-R. I will say this, if you're getting those books, they're very readable. But his area of expertise is the Old Testament and the Old Testament languages, and sometimes he does get into quite a technical discussion about the language, and that's not a bad thing. I think it's important to understand the language. The other book that I would recommend are both written by a guy by the name of Godwa. I can't think of his first name off the top of my head.
Brian, I believe.
Brian, that's it. It's G-O-D-W-A. The first book is When Giants Ruled the Earth. Or When Giants, I think it was Ruled the Earth. And the other book is When Watchers ruled the nations, and both books are really very interesting and well done. And again, they're very footnoted, so you'll have lots of source material in those books as well.
And Bill,
yes,
his last name, I was looking that up. It was Godawa.
Okay. Misspelled it. Okay. Very good to know. But yeah, he's got some interesting material. You know, and I think anybody that really has an interest in this topic, I think those books are really worth reading. So that takes us into where we are tonight. Last week, we spent a lot of time looking at Israel in the Transjordan, and how Israel actually conquered the areas of the Transjordan. And we also looked at the idea of God's commands to wipe out every man, woman, and child within certain groups in that area. And we looked at why that was so. And it dealt with the Raphim and the Nephilim and the fact that the giants were in that area and God was eradicating that bloodline. So, what I want to pick up today, and I'm going to look at this, and I think it'll be interesting, is I want to look at the impact of Israel penetrating into Canaan and establishing itself as an independent state. Now, I'm going to say right from the get-go that this does not solve the problem of what we'll call cosmic geography for Israel. It did not solve it. If anything, it sharpens the conflict between God and the Elohim that are ruling the nations. Israel now would be surrounded by hostile nations and the gods that are overseeing those nations. And there are also pockets of divine resistance within Israel itself. And oftentimes we forget that. But Israel was unfortunately not a nation that was 100% on God's side. Many people within Israel were really divided and really had allegiance with these other Elohim of the nations. The period of the judges in the monarchy form a tale of military and spiritual struggle. On the ground, Israel was hamstrung by the vestiges of the Raphim and Nephilim who had escaped annihilation in the conquest that we looked at last week. We ended last week briefly looking at Joshua chapter 11 and verses 21 through 23, where we saw that some of the Anakim had not been destroyed, and that the Anakim later on would really become what we think of as the Philistines. And the Philistines would be Israel's chief enemy during this time frame in the early parts of the United Monarchy. Spiritually, then, the conflict had high stakes as they signaled the infiltration of other gods that would be siphoning off Israelite worshipers into their own cults. Since believing loyalty to Yahweh is foundational to Yahweh's protection and their remaining in the land, the spiritual battle was just as big a threat as the physical one. And I think sometimes we minimize that. The books of Joshua, or the books of Judges, Samuel, and Kings, The books of, again, I'm looks like I'm having a little bit of issue with the internet, so I'll repeat the last statement in case you missed it. The books of Judges, Samuel, and Kings clearly describe the military conflict. That's the one that's easy to see with our modern eyes through a modern worldview. But underneath the surface, there's a war of a different nature that is raging. And we're going to cover a few examples of that tonight. When Moses was told to construct the tabernacle and its equipment, or pieces of furniture, the Bible tells us that God revealed a pattern for doing so. If you want to look here at Exodus chapter 26 and verse 30, Exodus 26 26 and verse 30. And it says here, then you will set up the tabernacle according to its layout, which you are shown on the mount. So it's interesting here that Moses was shown a pattern, a layout, when he was on the mount. Hebrews makes reference to this, that there was a pattern in the heavens. The tabernacle is a major thing that oftentimes doesn't get the due recognition it should in our studies. In the Old Testament, there are over 40 chapters devoted to its construction and how Israel is to be laid out in accordance with it. If God is spending 40 chapters giving us information about one specific topic, do you think that topic might be a little important? It's really important. It is the place where the name would dwell. Now, again, we did a study a few weeks back dealing with the name, and I don't want to rehash all of that here, but if you get an opportunity to go back and look at that study, I would recommend it. The implication of God having Moses follow a divine pattern is that the tabernacle tent structure on the earth was to be a copy of the heavenly tabernacle. As in heaven, so on earth. The heavenly tent prototype was the heavens themselves. Now go with me to Isaiah 40 so you can see this. Isaiah chapter 40. And I want verse 22. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 22. It is he who sits over the circle of the earth, so that its dwellers are like grasshoppers, who is stretching out the heavens like thinnest gauze, and is billowing them out like a tent to dwell in. That word translated tent here is the word oftentimes translated as tabernacle. Okay? Again, let me read that so we can really get the full impact of what's being said here. It is he, meaning Yahweh, who sits over the circle of the earth, so that its dwellers are like grasshoppers, who is stretching out the heavens like thinnest gauze, and is billowing them out like a tent to dwell in. The only tent that God has dwelt in is the tabernacle. Right? Now, interestingly here, we can say, then, that the heavens and that tent that God's dwelling in the heavens is the prototype for what Moses built. Now, the heavens and earth were conceived of as Yahweh's true tabernacle or temple. The earthly dwelling place erected by the Israelites mimicked the grand habitation of the cosmos. Okay, we need to understand that. The tabernacle was not only the abode of Yahweh, It was also his throne room. Okay? It was also his throne room. Yahweh sits over the circle of the earth. Now, there's an interesting verse for anybody that believes in a flat earth. Okay? Just think about that. Okay? Okay, Yahweh sits above the circle of the earth in his heavenly tent on his throne above the waters that are above the firmament and rests his feet on the earth. Go with me to chapter 66 of Isaiah. Okay. Chapter 66, verse 1. Thus says Yahweh, the heavens are my throne, and the earth my footstool. Where then is the house that you shall build for me? And where then is the place of my rest? The Ark of the Covenant is in God's tabernacle or temple. And the sacred object, the Ark, is associated with Yahweh's presence, his name. Now, in 2 Samuel 6, if somebody'd like to take that, 2 Samuel 6.
I've got it.
Okay, can you read the first two verses, Phil?
Yeah. David again gathered all the choice men of Israel, three contingents. Then David and all the people with him set out and went to Baal of Judah to bring up from there the copper of the one Elohim over which the name is called, the name of Yahweh of hosts, dwelling over the cherubim.
Now, it's interesting. Notice the connection with the ark and the name. Okay? The word Shem, which means name, appears twice in this verse. Now, a lot of Bibles mistranslate it, and they'll translate it somewhere along the line like this. The ark is called the name of Yahweh of hosts. The point is that the ark is identified with the name, who is Yahweh, since Yahweh is the one seated on the cherub. But many, many English translations misrender it, and they render it, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts. And they leave out the second use of the name of the word Shem, which is translated name. The reason for this is that most scholars believe it to be just an act of redundancy. And they believe this because they miss the significance of what God is communicating. The ark being called the name is understandable since the ark was a placeholder for the presence of Yahweh. Think about that. Who is the name? Yahweh is the name. This same association is conveyed in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, if you want to turn chapter over. And can somebody read verse 2?
That the king said unto David the prophet, see now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells within curtain.
Now notice what you have here. You have anthropomorphic language, because you have an ark that is being said to dwell. normally we would say, I have a couch and it's in my, or something along that line. I have a coffer and it's located. For something to dwell implies life. It implies presence. Now, the tabernacle traveled with Israel during the entire journey to the promised land. Once Israel penetrated the land, the Ark of the Covenant, and therefore the tabernacle structure, was situated at Bethel. Okay, that would be Judges chapter 20 and verse 27, where we get that information. The name Bethel literally means house of God. Yeah, the house of God. Bethel is the place where Jacob had his encounter with Yahweh and the angels of his counsel atop the ladder in Genesis chapter 28. It was the place where the angels of God appeared to him again while he was fleeing from Esau, his brother, in chapter 32 of Genesis. And it is the place where Jacob builds an altar and a pillar to commemorate the appearance of the visible Yahweh in chapter 31 of Genesis. Sometime later, the tabernacle would move from Bethel to Shiloh. Once that move occurred, it was said that the house of God was Shiloh. Go with me to Judges 18 to see this. Judges 18. And in Judges 18, we're going to look at verse 31. Okay, 18:31. They kept the carving of Micah that he had made, set up for themselves all the days, while the house of the one, Elohim, was in Shiloh. And again, that same terminology would be used. I'll give you a couple other places where Shiloh is referred to as the house of God, with the tabernacle or being, or the temple, actually the tabernacle being there. You would see it again in 1 Samuel 1, verse 24. And Jeremiah makes a reference to it in Jeremiah chapter 7, in verse 12. The Old Testament indicates that Shiloh became the place of sacrifice. Now, again, we would see that in Judges chapter 21, if you want to turn there, in verse 19. Then they said, behold, from days to days, there is the festival of Yahweh at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, toward sunrise of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Labona. Now notice, there is the festival of Yahweh at Shiloh. At the festival would be the sacrifices. So Shiloh becomes a significant place. At Shiloh, we would see the boy Samuel encounter the physicalized Yahweh, the Word, in 1 Samuel 3. Eli the priest later foolishly sent the Ark of the Covenant out to battle, and it fell into the hands of the Philistines, who took it to Ashdod and installed it in the temple of their god, Dagon. And in a fascinating, and I think really funny, incident of cosmic geography, Yahweh's presence destroyed the statue of Dagon. And in 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 5, we're going to get the reaction of the Philistine priests. So in 1 Samuel 5 and verse 5, let's read that. Therefore the priests of Dagon and all those entering the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of the house of Dagon at Ashdod until this day. Now, the reason they don't tread on it is because Dagon was destroyed by Yahweh. The threshold, then, is now Yahweh's geography, not Dagon's. They dare not walk on it, because to do so would be an act of war against Yahweh. And he would deal with them accordingly. It's fascinating when you read this. Eventually, the Ark would be brought to Jerusalem. At first, David placed it in a temporary tent he had made for it, according to 2 Samuel 6, under the assumption that he was going to build a temple for it. Now, it would later on be removed from the place that David had placed it because of civil unrest caused by the civil war with Absalom. In the meantime, the place of sacrifice would become Gibeon, where we are told the tent of meeting was. That's interesting, because it would mean that the house of God moved to Gibeon then. Right? And again, we would see that in 2 Chronicles chapter 2. Like the tabernacle, the temple also contains striking imagery associated with Eden.
Oh, wow.
Eden is a lush garden in a holy mountain. The tabernacle's tent enclosure contained furnishings and decorations that evoked Edenic imagery. All you have to do is read the instructions of how it's built and what's engraved and so on. All of these motifs, the tent, the mountain, and the garden come together in the temple, the fixed place where Yahweh was considered to dwell and order the earth and the heavens with his counsel. Unfortunately, many Bible readers assume that once the temple was built, the tabernacle was forgotten. In reality, the tabernacle tent with its Holy of Holies was moved into the temple with the Ark. Now, recall, put on your thinking cap, recall that within the tabernacle was another building, completely covered with curtains, called the Holy Place. This room was divided in two by a veil, behind which was the Holy of Holies, the room that contains what?
Presence, Ark.
The Ark. And if the Ark is there, right, if the Ark is there, what else is there from what we've read?
The name.
The name.
Yeah.
His name, his presence, as Phil said. And again, this is significant. The inside of the temple also has this same type of inner room arrangement. It's a fascinating thing. You have the outer court within the temple, right? Then you go into the inner courtyard in the temple. And what's in the inner courtyard? The bronze altar, the bronze sea, the altar of incense, the veil, and the ark. It's fascinating when you start to look at it. Most people really think that the tabernacle's done away once the temple comes into existence, but it's not. It's incorporated into the temple. Fascinating thing when you begin to look at this. There's one major difference, though, between the inner sanctum of the temple and that of the tabernacle. The inner area of the temple had two giant cherubim in it, standing side by side, the tips of their wings stretching across to touch each other like this, rather than being like this, which was in the tabernacle. The effect of this was that the cherubim wings formed the seat of the throne for Yahweh. That's the difference. The ark then becomes Yahweh's footstool.
Oh.
Okay. Now, it's interesting when you read all this and study this. In the temple, the imagery of Yahweh on his throne and living in the ancient tent is preserved. The temple of Yahweh in Israel was naturally associated with a cosmic mountain dwelling like Sinai, because it is situated in Jerusalem on what? What mountain is that?
Mount Zion.
And what's Mount Zion?
The Lord.
The new Zion. Psalm 48 makes this clear for us. Let's go to Psalm 48. I want to look at the first two verses there. Psalm 48. In the first two verses. Great is Yahweh, and praised exceedingly, in the city of our Elohim, his holy mountain, lovely of undulation. The elation of the entire earth is Mount Zion, the flanks or the sides of the north, the town of the great king, Elohim and her citadels. Remember when we looked at the sides of the north in a previous study? And we saw that the sides of the north is where the divine council meets. This is all important information that we're having here that is spelling out for us that the heavens set a pattern for what's on the earth. Okay? God's throne in the heavens is patterned on the earth. God lives in his throne in the heavens, and he intends to live on his throne on the earth at some point. You have two places where God resides. Heaven, earth. Those will be significant when we get into the New Testament. Because what we're going to see once we get into the New Testament, this conflict between the rebellious Elohim and God is a conflict that takes place in heaven and on earth. And God is going to use two different groups of people to wage that conflict for him. He's going to use an entity called the body of Christ to operate in the heavens, and he's going to use an entity called Israel to operate on the earth. Okay? This is really critical because so many people get this wrong and they try to make both entities the same thing. They are not. And they reside in two different places, in two different realms, with two different purposes. Now, Zechariah chapter 8, verse 3, reiterates the same idea that we just read in Psalm 48. And you don't have to turn there, but I'll read it here. I won't turn there. Zechariah 8:3, if you want to jot it down in your notes.
8:3,
yep. Anyone who studies a map and is familiar with how Jerusalem looks from that map or has maybe visited Jerusalem, they can tell you that Mount Zion really isn't much of a mountain. It certainly is not located in the geographical north. It's actually in the southern part of the country. So what's meant by the sides of the north? Or as the Concordant renders it, the flanks of the north. What's meant by that? Well, by way of review, this description is familiar to Israel's pagan neighbors, particularly at Ugarit. It's out of the Ugaritic literature where the phrase sides of the north first occurs. It's typically rendered heights of the north with the word Zaphon. Am I pronouncing that right, Phil?
Zaphon, okay.
Wasn't sure if I get the pronunciation correct there. Zaphon. This is the place where Baal lived in the Ugarit. And supposedly he ran the cosmos at the behest of his high god, El, in the divine council. So what the psalmist is doing is stealing glory from Baal, restoring it back to Yahweh, to who it rightfully belongs, and it literally becomes a doctrinal slap in the face to the divine council that's in rebellion against Yahweh. This is why the description sounds odd in terms of Jerusalem's geography. This is why Isaiah and Micah use phrases like the mountain of the house of Yahweh in Isaiah 2 and verse 2, or Micah chapter 4 verse 1. These descriptions are designed to make a doctrinal point, not a geographical one. Zion is the center of the cosmos, and Yahweh and his council are its king and administrators, not Baal. That's the point that they're trying to make. The temple is also the Edenic garden, full of lush vegetation and animals. The description of the temple's construction in 1 Kings chapters 6 and 7 is explicit in this regard. And I'm not going to go to those chapters and read through it. It's a lengthy read. But you will find in 1 Kings chapter 6 and 7, flowers, palm trees, gourds, cypress trees, cherubim, lions, pomegranates, all adorning the temple via carved and architectural features. In Ezekiel's vision of the new temple, in chapters 40 through 48, he sees a temple built on a high mountain. That's chapter 40, verse 2. Whose courts are decorated with palm trees. Again, chapter 40. The interior is decorated with more palm trees and cherubim. Chapter 41. Ezekiel's temple garden is well watered, like Eden, since a river flowed from it that supernaturally gave life to everything else. Chapter 47. In Israel's doctrine, Eden, the tabernacle, Sinai, and the temple are all equally the abode of Yahweh and his counsel. Israel had the tabernacle and the temple, and it was to be a constant reminder of the fact that they had the God of the cosmic mountain and the cosmic garden living in their very midst. And if they obeyed him, Zion would become the kingdom domain of Yahweh and would serve as a place to which he would regather the disinherited nations cast aside at Babel to himself. Go with me to Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4. And if somebody could read verses 1 and 2, that would be a wonderful thing. Micah chapter 4, verses 1 and 2.
In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
It's interesting. Did you notice one of the interesting things that's recorded here? Correctly, it's talking about hills originally, right? And then hills are called the mountain of the Lord, or the mountain of Yahweh, in verse 2. Which, again, goes back to what I was just saying.
Bill, may I make a comment?
Sure.
Apparently, in most translations of the Old Testament, El Shaddai is usually translated as God Almighty.
Right.
But apparently, in the last few years, they've discovered that a more correct translation is the God of the mountain.
Right. And it's interesting because, really, the God of the mountain is a good rendering. It really is. It's a fascinating thing. So,
because until Moses was there at the burning bush, God had never revealed his name.
Right, right. He never had. I think the interesting thing, too, that we see here in Micah 4 is the idea that Zion becomes the domain of Yahweh, and it serves as the place where he regathers the disinherited nations. The nations are coming to him. They're flowing to him. He's regathering them. Hence then, it becomes critical for us to see how this all fits together. Now, why did I spend an entire session tonight talking about the Ark and the Temple? Because this is where God resides. This is where the divine council meets. And as we get closer into the New Testament, and as we finish up some of the loose details in the Old Testament, it becomes more and more paramount for us to understand this relationship. Now, next week, I want to deal with the idea of unholy ground and look at some things dealing with that and the idea of the prophets and how they relate to this whole thing. Because, again, I think it's going to become critical, and eventually, within the next 3-4 weeks, I want to really get into the New Testament and begin to look at the idea of Messiah and some things about him. So, any questions on what we covered tonight?
Manly comment.
Sure.
In 1 Samuel chapter 5, you mentioned about Dagon entering Dagon's temple as Ashtoreth, step on the threshold.
Right.
Now, I don't think modern couples do it now when they get married, but the idea was the husband lifted his wife as they stepped into the new house to make sure she didn't step on the threshold. Now, it makes me wonder if this was an old superstition, that if you stood on the ship, on the threshold, exactly the same thing would happen in Dagon's temple.
Well, I don't know. Actually, I can explain that one, Jim.
No.
I really can. The reason for that is it all goes back to the imagery of a Jewish wedding, where the groom would come for the bride, and he would literally take the bride into the chambers, the wedding chambers, and the marriage would be consummated. That's where they officially become one flesh. If she steps on the threshold, it's two different flesh going into that abode. So the idea was, you want one flesh going into the abode because they're becoming one. And that was the idea.
Right. So, you know, like it says in Genesis, that the husband and wife become one flesh.
Right. That was the idea. Kind of fascinating.
Very fascinating. You know, it's surprising what comes up, isn't it?
It is.
Well, I had a question. You had mentioned that I don't know what point it was, that the angels in the temple, apparently, become the...
Oh, the cherubim, yes.
Throne.
Right.
Yeah. They become the throne and the ark and become the footstool.
Right.
What becomes of the mercy seat?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, again, the mercy seat is the throne. So, it's interesting. I don't know, my computer is acting a little glitchy here, but the wings literally become that mercy seat, if you will. It's the mercy seat is technically the idea of where the seat is that Yahweh sits on. So really,
well,
The cherubim were one piece with the...
That's right.
With Christ, the mercy seat, the lid, or whatever, was all
right.
One piece.
That's correct.
Right. Small, one piece of solid gold.
Right. Which is interesting when you look at it in that context. But yeah, it just literally becomes the mercy seat. No, I can hear you. Yes.
Okay. The mercy seat, by its dimensions, was just big enough to allow for a human being to sit on.
That's correct.
Okay. So are you saying now that God is not actually sitting on that mercy seat?
In the temple?
Yes.
I'm saying he's actually sitting on the wings of the cherub. That literally becomes a seat.
And it's just become a seat. He's sitting on the wings of the cherub?
Yes.
No. Okay, I've never heard that before.
Yes. Their wings.
That's why I had.
Their wings stretch out. It's interesting if you look at the temple, right? And you read the way it's constructed. The seat literally becomes those wings.
Mm.
That is the seat. We think of it as a separate chair, but it's not. It's not referenced that way in Kings.
You're saying the mercy seat becomes his footstool?
The ark becomes his footstool.
Yes. So the mercy seat is integral.
The mercy seat, you're thinking the tabernacle. Think the temple.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Instead of the angels being like this,
yes,
they're like this.
Right, like this, with their wings touching the tip.
And they're touching. Where the hands touch, like you see the tip of my hand, my fingers? Okay, the other angels would be, the other cherubs' fingers would be touching it. That actually constitutes the mercy seat.
Oh.
And his feet are on the ark. The ark becomes his footstool.
All right. But what I don't understand is if the blood was to be placed on that lid, it doesn't seem to fit with a person putting their feet there, even if it is God himself, if that's where the Son's blood is going to be placed.
On the ark, you mean, right?
Yes, on the ark, the lid of the ark. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, even if you have it the other way, it's the same problem, right?
What other problem?
Well, he's sitting on it, right?
Yeah, I guess, right. The way it's hard to
So, I mean, what would be the difference from one to the other?
If you're sitting on it and your feet on it, what is that
To me, I would say it would be more problematic to be sitting on the blood than having your feet on the blood.
No, putting your feet on something is a sign of contempt or disregard.
No, it can also be the sign of victory.
Yeah, victory over
sin. Victory. What's contained within the ark? Right. What's the Ten Commandments? Okay, so you have victory over the condemnation of the law. Right? Isn't it victory over the condemnation of the law?
Yes, it is. That's the Christ does that.
Right? Isn't it victory over sin and despair, which only enters via the law?
Okay.
So to place his feet upon that is showing he's victorious over it, not contempt.
Yeah, okay. Have to see it that way.
Yeah. That's kind of how I see it, at least at the present.
While I'm in the hot seat here, can I share a comment?
Sure.
When Israel is taken away from the land by Babylon, that would be, of course, Judah. We notice that once the city is left desolate,
right,
you will see that many of the inhabitants that they had expelled earlier would blow back in and take over. But that never happened. One thing I can think is that the Lord keeps that for himself in the hopes that people peace and the thorns and the thistles, the
right.
wilderness.
Right. Well, when we get a little bit further into the Old Testament, which you'll be within the next couple of weeks, I really do want to look at Ezekiel for a little bit, because there's some things in Ezekiel that I think are really important for us to fully grasp.
The other thing I wanted to ask about, because it seems you were talking about the items that were in the tabernacle actually became the items that were in the temple.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct.
So we're not talking about two different arcs.
No, it's the same ark.
It's the same ark, okay.
Mm-hmm.
The ark and probably the altar of incense was the same, but there were in the temple different lampstands. In fact, there were like 10 of them.
Right.
Different labors. There was a enlargement and multiplication of things.
Right. And you also have pillars that are in the temple that are not in the tabernacle.
Yeah. And the other thing was, it never really specified that God, you know, I'm sure that we had referred to the ark as his throne, but we've never referred to it as him being seated on the ark in the temple.
Right.
Because it's always been the Shekinah glory. It's not like we're picturing a human being sitting on his throne.
Right. We are. And it's kind of hard for us to get that imagery in our head of how God's actually there.
Right.
You know, if I could explain that in a way that would be really simple, I'd be doing something.
One more thought, Bill?
Okay.
We touched on Dagon.
Right.
The statue of Dagon was actually beheaded.
It was.
The second time it fell, the head came off.
Man.
We've been talking about the giants. Also in 1 Samuel, Goliath, the giant, was beheaded.
That's right.
Also in Samuel, the king who apparently started out for Israel but turned around and was persecuting David and the true Israelites was beheaded. Much like, puts me in mind of the man of lawlessness, Saul was trying to step into the place and take what wasn't his, trying to step into the office of the priest sometimes and was failing and so forth. In the 1800s, there was a lady by the name of Ada Habershon who did some Bible studies, and she's the name Gilgal means rolling, and Gal is the idea of the head or pole sometimes. Because it's round and it rolls, that kind of an idea. And, you know, in Gilgal, the reproach was rolled away when they were circumcised and so
right.
forth. Her suggestion was that she thought that the name Golgotha was a contraction of Gal Goliath, or the head of Goliath. We find at the end of Samuel that the head of Goliath was taken and the pile of stones raised over it. Because we're thinking about the giants and all these things, it all kind of comes together, the idea of Christ's victory over the spiritual beings, over the giants. And Colossians chapter 2 about the sovereignties and the authorities being made a travesty of. So
right.
A lot of good thoughts all come together there.
They do. There's a lot there. I mean, it's really well worth a person's time to actually study out the events of what's going on with David and Goliath, and some of the things that David does after he chops off Goliath's head.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it says that he took his head and buried it in Jerusalem.
Right.
Yeah.
Why Jerusalem? I mean...
And that's what Goliath of Gath.
Right. Right. And, you know...
So the skull, whose skull was it? Was Goliath's skull that David had buried there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really amazing when you start getting into all that stuff, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate what you just said, Phil. That was good.
Okay.
Anyone else, sir?
I see like a covering around the linens that were used in the temple around it. It's almost like we're going to find that out, I think, in these studies, that that's like the Elohim were supposed to be protecting us as a covering, and they're not. You know, and then the New Jerusalem, which is 1,200 miles square, that's going to be right there. It's amazing what's going on here.
There's a lot there.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating when you, again, I hate using that word over and over again, but there is a lot of profound things when you start really digging into what's recorded about the temple or the tabernacle, and then see some of the things that God says later on about his throne and his abode. It's pretty amazing. But, yeah.
That's one of the other things about cutting off the head of someone was almost like a trophy.
Yeah. Right. That's right. Definitely like a trophy. So, it definitely was very much like a trophy, almost like you know how the native indigenous people to the America would take the scalps, right? Actually, I think that was more a French thing first, and the Indians actually incorporated it.
Yeah, we talk
about how to
do that.
Yeah,
not smart.
But. Well, any other questions?
What time is it in Great Britain? It's nearly 1:15 in the morning. Now then, it better be 1:05 while I can be watching this and listening to it. In love. Thank you.
Well, is that my buddy Dan Sheridan?
Question?
I think
that was Ted.
Oh, was it?
No, Ted. Ted's new friend.
Oh, okay.
Well,
that's good. That's good. Well, if that's it on any questions, why don't we close in a word of prayer then? Ted, could you close us?
Sure. Dear God, Father, we thank you again for this great time of fellowship that we are privileged to be a part of. We thank you for, again, the work and the diligence that Bill has and meditating upon words to present these things consequence to us. And we may gain greater realization, appreciation of you and all that you are going to accomplish through your son. That I couldn't help think that, you know, as we're talking about this tabernacle and the temple, how these are showing forth your presence and where you dwell. And yet we know that from Ephesians 2, for example, that we are actually in our, even to this day, in this day right now, where you abide. You dwell in us, and you will dwell someday in all your creation. And such great things to think about. And we just pray that you'll be with us as we continue to meditate and think about these things that have been presented, that we can continue to grow closer to you, and be thankful for you as our great God and Savior, and continue to be with those names that were brought forth in the beginning. Father, we again remember them as we close, and be with each one now as we depart.